Connecting our city and South Cambridgeshire. Cambridge 105 Radio.
I'm going to read you the menu. It's fantastic.
Cambridge is right, this sort of thing.
What's it like? Delicious.
Good afternoon and welcome to Flavour, and thanks to Ollie Slack for From the Pavilion. And now it's time for an hour of edibles and drinkables with Alan Alder, Sue Bailey and myself, Matt Bentman.
Amongst our features today, Tim Hayward's forthcoming book that celebrates 100 years of Fitzbillies.
So we started digging back into the history of cake shops, and it's absolutely astonishingly weird, and it's kind of an untold story.
We go from the old to the new as we visit the just-opened Little Petra in Mill Road.
We go through about 90 kgs of chickpeas a month and 30 kgs of aubergine a week.
And I'm a farm boy, so I know what those weights mean in terms of carrying bags of seeds on my shoulder. That's a hefty amount of chickpeas.
Yes.
We've some ideas for broad beans from Jamie Mountford, Tristan Welch and Rosie Sykes.
Broad beans are great. When they're tiny, I personally would just eat them raw. They're delicious. One of the favourite tapas I ever had when I used to live in Spain was just a pile of tiny broad beans, but still in their pods, and some jamon.
World food ideas too from Gemma Whiting of Linton Kitchen.
They're in abundance in British hedgerows, and yeah, you can lightly fry the stalks, you can eat the leaves, like sprinkle them on top of salad.
Also today, there's some quite surprising health food history.
Cocoa suddenly became a health food. It had always been sort of medicinal since its origins.
And Sue visits Noel Young at NY Wines, the new wine bar and shop in Shelford. We've also have our free food feature, our look at what's happening on Twitter, our news section, and one or two other items. Tequila!
We've heard a lot about war and heroism this week. Surprisingly, war, in this case the First World War, played a part in, of all things, cake shops. And here in Cambridge led to the opening of Fitzbillies. Fitzbillies has its 100 years anniversary next year, and Sue spoke with co-owner Tim Hayward about it.
Fitzbillies are going to be having their 100th anniversary.
100th anniversary next year. So we're doing a book, which is a sort of combination of, I suppose, stories and recipes, really. So we've got a fair amount of social history about that kind of shop and the high street anyway. Then the specific history of Fitzbillies, our story about catching it and sort of rebuilding, resetting it up, and then a bunch of recipes, really. And I'm at the moment working on profiles of sort of five key members of staff, which also sort of tell the story through it. And we're in the middle of shoots as well, so all the shoots are being done. We've got a studio at the house, so we did 3 days last week, which was pretty intense. We've got 2 days tomorrow and the day after of photography, and then I think the last 2 days we'll probably have the photographer go loose in the shops and the bakery and get background stuff. But it should be good. Yeah.
Given I'm interested in the food history side of things. Tell me a bit more about what you're planning on doing on food history in relation to culture and so on.
Well, it's a weird thing. I think Al and I both come from a background of marketing and sort of brand science and things like that. And I think one of the things we've often talked about as we've had the business going is sort of what's the civilians often call it a USP, a unique selling point. And it's actually not really the correct term, but that's the closest to what we're after. Some kind of brand salience, some kind of something that sort of just makes it stand out a bit. And we realised that we're one of the last surviving sort of high street English fancy cake shops. And we realised that at no point in Fitzbillies history had it pretended to be a patisserie. And it definitely wasn't viennoiserie, and we wondered why this was. So we started digging back into the history of cake shops, and it's absolutely astonishingly weird, and it's kind of an untold story. But basically, of immigrants in the UK by number was Germans and Austrians. And there were four major businesses that they pretty much took over. One of them was German bands. Dance bands. Because before we had pipe music and jukeboxes and record players even, every pub had to have a band. And these bands of German sort of umpath players would travel from pub to pub to pub to pub and other places where sort of large groups of working class people would hang out. And they play this sort of dance music. And if you think about our image of you know, Victorians having a high old time, the good old days, it always has that kind of kind of polka dance music. And I'd never realised what that sort of German connection was. And then sugar refineries. So the big sugar businesses were all run by Germans. One of the largest ones was run by Stephen Fry's dad. Really? In Norfolk, yes. Oh, a bizarre thing. That's where Stephen Fry's family came from, where they were the German sugar manufacturers. Because they had the science, they had the technology, and, you know, it was one of the things that they did better than us in the Industrial Revolution. And then there was, weirdly, cake shops and bakeries. And the Germans had taken over the cake shop and bakery business, and they were doing it brilliantly. They were fantastic. They had a great tradition of bakery, but it wasn't sort of Ponzi or French range or anything like that. And then suddenly, 1914, we have the biggest civil unrest in the UK in history. We effectively, I mean, it's wrong in one way, I suppose, to compare it to Kristallnacht, but we have, in every major city, we have people putting bricks through the windows of any business that sounds German, Austrian, Czech, or any of the other enemy powers. And this happened over the first 2 years of the war regularly. And these things were huge. And people were sort of dragged out of their beds and beaten up, and people had to be arrested for their own safety. Then they start internment. But effectively, all of the German businesses stop dead in 1914. And so that kind of a lot of the high street cakeries just shut down, stone dead in 1914, which is a really weird thing. And we can't actually nail it specifically to Cambridge. We don't know if there were riots in Cambridge. We haven't been able to find it out. But there was such a strong element of anti-German feeling that these cake shops all closed down. Coming back from the war, you've got completely deserted high streets. There have been no men for a long time. So many businesses have collapsed. And people are, there's a lot of guys are coming back with their demob money. And they have this tremendous, you know, entrepreneurial spirit. This is a country fit for heroes. You know, we fought for this. We're going to come back. We're going to do our thing. And they were looking, a lot of them were looking to set up businesses. And the businesses they were able to set up, obviously there was a requirement for high street bakeries. The companies that made bakery equipment and sold flour were really, really keen to finance these guys. And so it was quite easy, particularly if, as the Mason brothers did, their dad had been running a confectioner's in Cambridge anyway through the war. They were straight up for it. So the Mason brothers started out Fitzbillies on their demob money into an environment that effectively, you know, needed this really badly. Very weirdly, the other business that was really, really heavily pushed to returning soldiers was fish and chips. The manufacturers and, weirdly, the potato farmers and the large fish organisations who'd been very organised, these were people largely who'd been reserved occupations and hadn't gone to war. When these guys came back, gosh, we can grow retail, we can grow the sales of this stuff really heavily. So those businesses all took off like a rocket. And the repertoire, what we bake in Fitzbillies, there's a thing about sort of fancy cakes, and fancy is a wonderfully English word, and we still see it. Some of the product we bring in, some of the sort of the flour or the syrup or something like that, very often it's fancy grade. And fancy, you won't see that word anywhere else. And fancy grade means it's better than economy, but it's certainly not anything as indecently indulgent as luxury or high class or premier or superior, which is the later grade that you see in most things. And Fitzbillies sells British fancy cakes. We're fancy sometimes because we do things like a macaroon, which is a bit foreign, but, you know, not so foreign it's going to trouble you because it's big and it's brown. And we have something called a Japanese cake. Because it's been called, throughout Fitzbillies history, it's been called a Jap cake, and we don't do that anymore. But I think that's the only thing we've actually changed. I mean, you know, that and the Eclair, which is, you know, it may have a French name, but it's not a French bun. And that's as far as we go. It's a fancy cake shop because it's fancy, but this level of democracy in the whole cell fascinates me. I mean, even the Lions corner houses and Tommy Lyons and things like that, they're a little bit Ponzi, they're a little bit white apron. And Fitzbillies wasn't that. It was emphatically not that. Now, strangely, I lived in the States for 5 years, so I was very, very obsessed with that. I worked in a lot of diners. And people always think they're sort of roller skating waitresses and rock and roll on the jukebox, and they're not. They're actually small, independent, hometown restaurants set up by usually immigrant families who are looking to try and get some kind of economic footprint in a town. And, you know, they survive by making ordinary democratic food as well as they can, following up on local favourites and you know, and just meeting everybody's needs in the town. And it just struck me massively that they grew post-Second World War in the States in the same way as the cake shops grew. And in my head, Fitzbillies is a diner. It's kind of... It's the democratic working class eating place. But it's not just working class, because actually there isn't a restaurant in the world that's got so many Nobelists on its customer list. Not one. There cannot be one. We know, we've proved it. Shelford's got more Nobelists living there at the moment than France has in its entire history. So we know we're doing all right.
The fascinating story of war, Fitzbillies and Stephen Fry's family. Many thanks to Tim Hayward, whose book will be out early next year.
Yeah, it really is fascinating. I can't see Fitzbiddies as a diner, though, but anyway.
Cake diner.
Now, there's a new cafe that's opened up on Mill Road. It is called Little Petra. It's been open about a month, and I went along to chat with the owners about their new business. Food is commonly used by Jordanians to express their hospitality and their generosity. Jordanians serve family, they serve friends and guests with great pride in their homes, no matter how modest their means. A Jordanian invitation means that you are expected to bring nothing and eat everything.
Yeah.
That is a brilliant description, because that is exactly how you feel. So as a outsider coming into a family home, when I first went over as Yassin's partner, it was about sitting down, having a meal together.
Yeah.
And the kitchen is the heart of the home in an Arab house. In Jordan, it's almost even more than that. It's making people feel at ease and that there are no barriers. So there's no distinction when you come into someone's house. Mm-hmm. They welcome you as if you're royalty.
My name is Yassin Helalat. I'm the owner for Little Petra in Cambridge.
It's the two of us. So I'm Catherine, Yassin's wife, and we've got a three-year-old son, Elias. He tells everyone it's his shop. It's Little Petra, 94 Mill Road, at the pedestrian crossing near St. Barnabas Church. Mm. So I always say when I go over to his family, I feel like the Queen of Sheba, because I am treated so well. But it is very much a Jordanian way of life. Yeah. And I think it's also very much a Bedouin way of life, because of the way they used to travel and people you met on your travels. You were all in the same boat or in the same desert. And that's what we wanted to bring to the cafe, that food is not just about feeding hunger, but it's about sharing a meal together, feeling you've got a place, home away from home, where you can enjoy your meal, that the children are free to be themselves. Because with a three-year-old, we found it was awful going out to have a meal, because you always felt guilty about your child. Was, you know, there was rice on the floor, or your child was shouting, and we just wanted to make sure that Little Petra is a place where people can come and feel comfortable and have a really wholesome, flavoursome meal. So we're pretty much kitted out for all age groups.
Yeah.
And we've catered a lot towards making sure all the things that we found annoying when we went out
with
a baby, that we've got all of that here.
Is the first Jordanian kitchen open in Cambridge?
I saw on your Facebook page, April the 27th was your starting time, yes?
Yes.
Yeah, just over a month now.
You both look very relaxed.
Well, so I still have a day job, and Yassin's pretty much running the cafe. And with all new businesses, it's about setting up, getting your routines right, making sure you found the right supplier. So initially, we went with what we knew. Now we've started to learn where is the best place to buy aubergine for the baba ganoush, the halal lamb for lamb shank on a Sunday.
I'm enjoying it. I'm actually enjoying it. You know, I love to work hard, and I'm the type of guy, I have no problem to work as much as is possible. You know, it's fine with me. It is so nice for me when I see my customer leaving and he got the smile. Something I always love to do is to share food, and I love to cook. So for me, it's nice when they are trying it and enjoying it. So it is very beautiful, you know. It's a very, very nice feeling for me. I don't know how to explain it.
Yeah.
That is one of the things that make me so happy to come in every day to work.
How did you two meet?
I was born in Rhodesia, grew up in South Africa. Yassin is through and through Bedouin. But I went on a pilgrimage to Israel 12 years ago. We stopped off in Petra for 2 days. Yassin and I got talking. It was another 3 years before we started dating. He definitely gets 10 out of 10 for perseverance. And it was another 3 years before we got married.
Jordan is an Arabic country between Israel, Syria, Iraq, and Saudi Arabia. Mm. Unfortunately, we are in a hot spot, but we are one of the most safe countries from all over the world, you know, very, very safe. I come from a very old place called Petra, from the Seven Winters in the War. It's a big city, it's built from Nabataean people, and it's a rich history. Jordan is a very, very rich history because it's part from the Holy Land.
Mm.
So one of my plans was, I don't want a lot of profit. So I have no problem to have a little bit of a profit for the sake of people enjoy, and I'm selling enough and everybody's happy in the two-way way. Mm. Not being greedy a little bit, so it works out for everybody good.
Yeah.
So for the customer and for me as a business, so yeah, this is one of our aim. People can come and afford to have a nice meal.
There's Petra and there's Little Petra. Obviously the name of your cafe is Little Petra. I was just wondering the reason why you chose Little Petra over Petra, seeing as you come from Petra.
So, So I'll answer this one. We wanted it to be something Jordanian, authentic. Petra was what we were hoping to call it.
Yes.
But we've got a three-year-old son. The long-term vision is that we will be able to start bringing mother groups, book clubs, trying to get more of a community during the weekdays because moms battle to find somewhere where they can go. So our strapline was going to be Little Petra, where children dream big. We've redone the courtyard out the back of the cafe. Now during summer, we're looking at putting in an area where children can play. For parents with older children, sort of 3-4-year-olds, the children can play in the courtyard and the parents can eat in a contained area where they don't have to worry about them sort of running off. So that's the plan. Yes, seen as visions of 50 children climbing up the walls, but... Yeah, it is about having a place for families to come. And then during the week, having things like mom's groups on a Monday, a book club Tuesday, craft Wednesday. Because that's one thing, and I think both of us have found this. Living in England, there's been that move away from community living of where you know your neighbour. And that's not the culture either of us have come from. Yassine comes from a really large family. I've got quite a big extended family. But everybody within the villages we grew up in knew each other. That, I think, both of us have missed living here.
Yeah. I mean, in our small way, that's exactly our mission as well. Mm. As a radio station, it's to bring the community closer together by involving the community and understanding how people know each other, you know, the networking that goes on, and just stories. Because that's all we have to go on with radio, really. You can't smell the food, you can't see the food. But we want to evoke that food through your voices, through the way you say what you say. You know, it's nice to capture that, I think.
Yeah.
As you said to me yesterday when we first met, everything here is fresh. There's fresh. No freezers on site.
No. We've got a small one.
We've got a small freezer for ice cream.
So when we do, we are trying to keep doing that because this is where we're going to be different to the others. Our food is fresh. This is how I take it. You know, I'm serving to my customer exactly how I would like it to myself. That's it.
One thing people have commented on repeatedly has been the baba ganoush because it tastes so very different to what they've had before because it is fresh. Made fresh, but the chef, you know, he really grills aubergine to the point where you get that smoky flavour with it. So the baba ganoush has been very popular, as has the lentil soup. And the way the lentil soup is made is a very traditional Arabic way of lentil soup.
One thing I would like to point out to the listener is you're a cafe. Now, when I think of cafes, I think of tea, coffee, a bun, maybe a fry-up. But you do full meals here as well. Just as an example, you do whole grilled sea bass. So you have full chicken meals, chicken and mushroom. There's a lot going on here. I think to call it a cafe almost feels a little bit misleading. It feels like it's the full deal.
It is. We do a dish of the day every day, which is a hot meal served with rice. Sundays we do lamb shank. We're not open in the evenings, Monday to Thursday. That's because we wanted to have the work-family life balance so that Yassine gets to see Elias when he gets home from nursery.
Yeah.
We will move in that direction
as
Elias gets a bit older, but he's three and...
But also, our customers always going to have a surprise with us. So this is why I got majority of people following me on Facebook. I'm planning a little bit of doing dinner things. So I know my wife, she will be not happy for me a little bit.
Friday, Saturday, Sundays, we're open until 10 p.m.
So this is I'm keeping a surprise for my customer.
As you can see here, we've got small fattaya, the different flavors. But what catches everyone's eye when they come in is the baklava.
I tried some of this yesterday.
Yes, really this beautiful. Is extremely Moorish. And some filled with walnuts, some filled with dates.
One thing I noticed about the baklava when I tried it yesterday, sometimes they can be so incredibly sweet, blow your head off sweet. This is not the case at all. These are much more refined, much more... They have like a sensible nature about them, but they still have that baklava sweetness.
Yeah, we've tried not to drown everything in syrup. And with a lot of the baklava, if you want to keep it for a long time, that syrup is almost its preservative. But because we are making it fresh, we don't need to keep it in a preservative. And then we've got a few traditional, I say traditional, we've got a few non-Arabic items like giant meringues, English-style cakes, and every now and then we have a few English-style biscuits in. Usually that's for children that come into the shop, so they don't always like something that looks different. We've then got shortbread, flapjacks for them.
Now, there was one thing I saw in your Facebook page. You had a video. You have many videos. But how do you pronounce this?
So that's basbousa. The video of him making it, the chef making it with a little flour on top.
Yeah.
Yeah, so the almonds are placed to look like sort of leaves, and then there's a small flower in the top of it, small rose.
So what I saw was an oven tray with perhaps, let's say, 100 of these slices. Yes. And then he was almost like dousing them with what looked like
rose water.
Yeah.
And we cook that in our large pizza oven. He does the traditional sweets in there.
Yeah. Oh, my word.
Yeah, you might be here for a while.
God, look at this. They'll
pick you up in the morning after your sugar coma. This is a mezze selection of falafel with tahina sauce, baba ganoush, hummus, labneh with nuts. Labneh is thicker than a Greek yogurt, but not a cream cheese. It's the only way I can describe it. And then pickles. Pickles are quite a big thing to have with your meals in the Middle East. One unique thing people ask every time they come in the shop is, what is the pink thing on the pickle plate? It's pickled turnips. And then the grilled halloumi, my favourite. That's when people come in and they want a bit of a selection of a mezze. It's quite nice if there's two or three of you. You get a little bit of everything. And that's another thing that is quite big in the Middle East, especially in family homes, is around, you all sit around the meal together. You're not eating off individual plates. It is very much that communal sharing. Sharing is very important.
So Yusen, Catherine, it's been great to meet you here at 94 Mill Road. This is Little Petra, and we wish you all the best and a lovely place.
Thank you, and so glad that you've spent some time with us this afternoon, and we look forward to seeing many other people from Cambridge coming in for breakfast, lunch or dinner.
Thank you so much.
And you're listening to Flavour on Cambridge 105 Radio. And that was Yassine and Catherine Hlelat of Little Petra in Mill Road, A Taste of Jordan. Now, they're also online where you can check out their full menu at littlepetra.co.uk, or you can go to Facebook as Little Petra, and that is all one word, by the way.
And here's news of free food available now in Cambridge or thereabouts, which you can find on the Olio app.
Yes, Olio, as we all should know by now, is the free-to-download on iOS and Android phones and tablets app. Using your location, it'll tell you the free food that is nearest to you. And if we look at Olio today, it tells me that Gale has an awful lot of fruit available, including pears, apples, grapes, bananas. Strictly 4 bananas per person, according to Gale. She's very particular. And she's based off Water Lane on the road to Impington. Meanwhile, Crystal, who lives next to Addenbrooke's hospital, has some breakfast cereal to give away, Crave specifically. She's opened it, but she's not a fan of the taste, and that's available to pick up now. And finally, Ivy, who lives over at Orchard Park, has another pot of Ballymallow Original Relish to give away. This is available for pickup in the evening. She can leave it in a safe place for you. So that is just a few of the things that's available on the Olio app.
And a reminder that some food outlets sell any unsold goods they have shortly before they close, and that's using the Too Good To Miss app. Our next feature isn't about free food, but it is almost. The liquid in cans of chickpeas, which almost everybody throws away, is known as aquafaba. And it can be used to make meringues, amazingly enough. We mentioned this on Flavour last year, but now there's an aquafaba cookery book and Alan has been having a look at it.
Yes, I was amazed when you mentioned this originally, Sue. So much so that I went home and had a go at making it. And yes, you can make meringues from chickpea water. But as this book, which is called Aquafaba, shows, its possibilities don't stop there. The book has 10 recipes for savoury dishes and another 10 sweet recipes, and then 5 for what to do with the chickpeas, so you don't throw them out instead. The savoury recipes include tomato and basil mousse, a mayonnaise, forager's millefeuille, and cappuccino soup. And of the last one, the writers say, coffee isn't something you'd normally associate with savoury dishes. However, it works surprisingly well. There's also a way of making pasta using aquafaba instead of egg. And the sweet dishes include almond meringues, eel flottante, lemon and bergamot meringue pie, French toast and Parisian waffles. The book has the traditional approach of a recipe with a photo opposite, and the photos are very good in making you want to make the dishes, I must say. And although it's marketed as a vegan cookbook, which it clearly is, it's also really useful in helping to avoid unnecessary waste and unnecessary expenditure.
But on the matter of expense, dried chickpeas are much cheaper than tin ones, but these recipes are just for tins.
Yes, but there's a section on how to make your own aquafaba. Interestingly, it's not the soaking water you use, it's the water you cook them in. And it's got times for pressure cooking too, which reduces energy use. There's also a section on what aquafaba is, scientifically, and how it was discovered by a French musician, not a food scientist. So, a useful book and an interesting book. It's called Aquafaba. It's by Sebastian Cardinal and Laura Veganpower, who's written several vegan books in France. It's published by Grub Street and it costs £12.99.
And can you get it in Cambridge?
Yeah, they had copies in Heffers recently and probably in Waterstones too.
Excellent. Now, staying on the subject of beans, broad beans are in season. The hardy ones that were sown last winter are now ready to eat, and here is Flavour's Liz Budd with some background.
Broad beans are eaten the world over. In countries such as China, Malaysia, Thailand, Peru and Mexico, they're fried with salt or spices to produce a crunchy snack. In many Arab countries, they're used in a breakfast dish called ful mudamas, a stew that includes parsley, onion, garlic, lemon juice and herbs. In Jordan, ful is similar to hummus, a dip. In Croatia, broad beans are used in stuffed artichokes. In the Netherlands, they may be eaten with fresh savoury and melted butter, or with crisp fried bacon.
And here are some ideas for what to do with them from local chefs. First, resident chef Rosie Sykes.
Broad beans are great. When they're tiny, I personally would just eat them raw. They're delicious. One of the favourite tapas I ever had when I used to live in Spain was just a pile of tiny broad beans, but still in their pods, and some jamon, and you just pop the beans out and eat them raw with a mouthful of jamon. Delicious. But I also, when they get a bit bigger, I think they're really nice to braise, so almost as if you were cooking a pulse or something. Maybe make a bit of a mirepoix, so some shallot, carrot, celery, bit of bacon or something. Sweat all that down, throw in the beans, a little bit of sherry if you've got it, but it doesn't matter if you haven't, maybe a bit of, and then some stock, and then just simmer them away. That way you can leave them in their thicker outer jackets. Otherwise, I do think, I'm afraid, which is quite a lot of work, it's worth blanching your broad beans and then popping them out of their thicker outer coats, because the outer coats are a bit bitter and they can be quite leathery. popping them out and making, I make a lovely sort of almost like a Greek salad with broad beans, tomatoes, red onions, some feta. Maybe some mild olives, some little gem, just dressed with olive oil and lemon juice is absolutely lovely as well.
Mm. The popping them out of the leathery skins. The skins are only leathery when they're
They're a bit bigger. I think when they're tiny, you really don't need to do that when they're small. But I think you'll realise, you know, what you could do is boil them, try one, see how you find it. If you find it bearable, go for it, because it is a lot of work. Good for keeping children quiet for a while, though.
The popping out of broad beans is the bane of the kitchen, according to Jamie Mountford, ex-Parker's Tavern and Cambridge Cookery and Bistro.
Oh, broad beans are a headache in the kitchen. Absolute headache. And, you know, you stand there, bored. Well, you're not bored. You know, you look for something to do in the kitchen. What do you need to do? I'll pick the broad beans. You know, when you take them out of the skin, there's so many of them. What I tend to do with broad beans, make a salsa, get some fresh peas, mix the broad beans once they've been picked out the skin. Never serve them on the skin. I hate the skin being served. It's a pet hate I have.
You mean, when you say the skin, not the pod, you're talking about the skin round the actual individual bean?
Yeah, definitely. I make a little salsa, add some sautéed onion and garlic. So when I say sautéed, just shallow fry them until they're cooked. Otherwise, the rest of the dish tastes too like raw onion. It's absolutely disgusting. But make sure you sauté them. Plenty of salt and pepper, because the broad beans just absorb it. But what you're trying to do when you're adding salt and pepper is you're releasing the flavour. So when you put salt on a slug, it explodes, doesn't it? Yeah. And that's what you're doing with the ingredients, is when you're adding salt, is you're adding salt to bring out more flavour, really. When you can taste the salt, it just don't add any more, basically. and plenty of olive oil. And then once again, you can use this with anything, really. You can, what I tend to do is do a sea bass dish. Use the broad beans in the summer into a bit of rocket, a bit of peppery flavour. Put the sea bass on top of the salad just before you serve it. Don't put it on too soon, because it will kill the leaves. And then just dress the dish with the broad bean salsa. Fantastic, yeah.
Well, that sounds all right to me. Tristan Welch from Parker's Tavern has a way of shelling the beans out of the skin in a rather easy way. Tristan, lots of broad beans around at the moment. Any good ideas for them?
Well, a glut of broad beans is never a bad thing, is it? So what I like to do is pod them, freeze them, and then you've got them for weeks and months to come. And then once they're frozen, they shell really easy. And then just throw them in a pan, touch of olive oil, touch of rosemary, some onions or shallots. I prefer sort of spring onions or shallots. They're slightly sweeter. And then crush them with a fork. And you crush them with a fork, that gives you the opportunity to put a touch of vinaigrette in or lemon juice, and it gives it an acidity against the sweetness. And then one of my guilty pleasures is that on some sourdough toast with a tablespoon of ricotta. Oh, delicious. Yes.
Broad beans on toast.
It's the fanciest beans on toast you'll ever have.
Yeah, some great ideas there.
And continuing on the ideas front, we have Gemma Whiting of Linton Kitchen along in a few minutes with some ideas for wild food.
But first, a new wine bar. It's been opened by Noel Young to replace their wine shop in Trumpington. I asked Noel why the move and why the wine bar.
Well, we've been looking to move for many, many years. I think our shop was very small. We could only ever fit out a certain amount of the range. And I've always wanted to sort of do something a bit grander than just be a straightforward shop. So I mean, I'd say we're looking for a long, long time, well over 10 years, but never found anywhere to move to. And whilst things were working, it was never sort of desperate. And then I saw this place where we are now in Shelford come up for rent back in July 17. Walked in, and as soon as I walked in, just knew it was the right place. Just had the right feel. I could just immediately imagine it. Wine bar, wine shop. It just spoke to me straight away. Took a hell of a long time to actually get in. I had an offer accepted on the lease back in August 17, but we only opened the doors middle of May this year, so it's been a long, long process getting here for a number of reasons, but now we're in, we're delighted to be here. And it's, I think, you know, retail is, as we all know in the press, is a difficult thing at the moment, and I think, you know, you've got to offer customers a bit more than just the standard experience. And we now, you know, we've got the space to be able to do that. We've got a lovely wine bar, so we can talk about wine and food matching. It just gives us the scope to do, you know, so many more things. I mean, it's, you know, the limits of our imagination, really.
The design and layout's absolutely beautiful.
Thank you. All these
lovely sort of rustic but slightly industrial feel to it, but lovely and light and airy, and lots of space for displaying your wines, of course.
Yeah, it's just great. So we can get a lot more stuff on display. And I spent a long time researching how I wanted it to look. my wife, who's not in the business ordinarily, has been sort of slightly more involved in the wine bar side of things. And we genuinely did go to a lot of places and a lot of wine bars around Europe and in London, looking at things, wine shops, looking at the hybrid model of sort of merchant and wine bar, looked at quite a few of them and came up with some ideas, and thankfully it all sort of came to fruition. I had a really good builder who's a customer, Steve Hartley, who'd been involved as well as a sort of the project manager, and he's had come up with some very good ideas as well. So it's been a sort of nice sort of collaborative thing, and it is great to see it all take shape and look as
I hoped. And you're doing special things like English Wine Week, which mm-hmm. you've just done, mm-hmm. and what have you got coming up?
So setting up, after 27 years, there's so much to do, and then setting up a brand new business with so many, there's lots of things you have to do, regulations and things, so it's been very protracted, and so just sort of getting open was a challenge, and then I suddenly saw English Wine Week come up on my Twitter feed, and so it gave me a really good idea, yes, we should do something about that, and that worked really well, actually. The wine sold well and were well received, which is great. So it's just a question of finding some time this week to think about what the next thing will be. I've got lots of ideas, but I haven't actually I'd like to do something like proper Lambrusco and charcuterie, for example, but it works brilliantly. I've been to Bologna 3 times in the last year and love it there, and it's just a great combination of people. I like the idea of trying to get people to try things that they probably don't. They are misconceived. A lot of people think of Lambrusco as being 5.5% sweet swill that you had at parties when you were 16, 17. But actually, it can be really delicious and dry. And whenever I give it to people, most people really like it. So that's the sort of thing we can do in the wine bar, and that's the sort of thing I'm really looking forward to.
Tell me now a little bit more about what you're planning to do on the food side.
Again, I spent a lot of time researching it. My wife's been really helping out on that a great deal, which is great. Slightly tapas style. We're doing charcuterie boards, both a really good English one and a Spanish one. Same with cheese. We've got a British cheese board and a European cheese board, and sort of more snacky items. And on a Thursday, Friday, Saturday and Sunday, we've got a range of hot specials. So for this last weekend, we always have a hot meat sandwich, so that's something like a slow-cooked shoulder of lamb done Greek style. We had a black bean chili, which is vegan, a Greek pork stew, a salad of roasted vegetables with a bit of feta, dill oil, mint and hazelnuts, and those sort of things. So we just try and... It's not very important. It's not people don't think it's a restaurant, but we want to be more than just somewhere that does cheese and ham, and nuts. We want to, so we really do want the food to be a part of it, but not the main part. Wine should always be the centre stage.
And, the nice thing is here, you're located well between Trumpington and Shelford. There's not really anything of this nature around in this area at all.
No, you'd have to go to pretty much centre of Cambridge to find anything like that. And again, I still don't think they're doing it the way we are. Again, I think, I'm not saying it's better, it's just how we decided to do it. And as I say, we're taking the food up a notch. And I think, that's what I wanted to do. And so far, it's been tremendously well received. So we'll crack on that with that for the time being. And it's such early days to know exactly where we're going to go. But I think we've sort of kind of hit the ground running, and we'll continue on that front. But what I don't want to do is be people to think it's about the food, and then you get reliant on a chef and those sort of things. I don't want to be doing that. You can then get sort of tied to it. And we have to also remember that whilst we've opened the wine bar, and it's great, the shop and the mail order and wholesale business is still our main business, and this is a nice addition.
How do you find the mail order and wholesale side of things, quite apart from the sort of customers coming into the shop? What's the sort of balance between the three?
Well, up until we moved, it's been a very nice balance. It literally is like a third. And I've always been very keen to make sure we're not overly reliant on one side of the business or the other. That would be very dangerous. So it's trying to keep all the channels open. Yeah, it works well.
And do you supply the colleges?
Yes. King's have been great supporters from the very start. We do a lot with them. And lots of Christ's we deal with regularly. St Catherine's, Trinity Hall, Corpus Christi, and plenty of others on a more of an ad hoc basis. But, the colleges are an important part of the business and always have been. And some are really quite progressive and have been great fun to work with. And some are much more traditional, which you kind of expect.
What would you say is your favourite wine of the wines that you sell?
I don't have one. I think wine is a fantastically sort of mood thing, and I think what you're eating, what you feel like, and so it's a question I get asked all the time: what's your favourite wine? And genuinely, there isn't one. I really love our Chacoly Rosé, for example, that's on at the moment by the glass. So Chacoly is from the Basque region in Spain, sort of little known, and it's relatively low alcohol, slightly sparkling, a bit like a Vina Verde in style, but drier and really quite delicious.
I have not come across that.
No, exactly. So a lot of people haven't done it, and that's been a bit of a hit. And most people have tried it, have then gone for a bottle, which is nice. So that's again the thing we can do now. We actually give people a little taste of it, and much easier than to taking a leap of faith and buying something you've never heard of for £15 off a shelf. Whereas you try a little glass, and it sort of works, which is great.
So your plan is to be having, apart from people tasting wines as they come in before they purchase, but to have some regular wine tasting.
We sort of kind of set aside Thursday night as a night where we're going to try and do more sort of themed nights. That might be we have a winemaker down, we might do wine dinners, we might do wine tasting. I haven't exactly got a programme together yet, but that's the night. And I think, yeah, we can do some interesting things. We can maybe do some sherry nights. We can do all sorts of things, you know. And they can be either with or without food, and we can just focus on the wine, or we can make it a more of a sort of gastronomic experience as well.
That was Noel Young from NY Wines in Shelford.
And you went there the other night, Sue, didn't you, as a customer? Did you have a good time?
I had a great time. I did try the Tsakali wine, actually. It was really interesting. Yeah, it was good, and nice food, nice choices.
Yeah.
Really good.
Right, good place then. Right.
And there's the music signalling the time for the latest food tweets from the city.
The Gog Farm Shop has tweeted to say they have a cheese festival on the 15th of June. One for you, Matt.
Mm.
Midsummer House have had some last-minute cancellations, so that means they have some availability in June. The Garden Kitchen says that their lunch special today is a hearty sweet potato and chickpea stew, just right for the weather. Mark Poynton has tweeted about his forthcoming dinner. That's next Friday. More about that in the news section at the end. And Alison McTaggart of Bread on a Bike has a new bread this week, plum and toasted fennel. Well worth a try, I would say.
Here on Flavour on Cambridge 105 Radio, we're planning to have a regular wild food and foraging feature. But as a sort of taster, first here's Linton Kitchen's Gemma Whiting with some very appealing ideas.
At the moment, I'm making some violet syrup, and out of my own garden, there's lilacs. So you can just use the flowers to make lilac sugar, and then you've got a lovely flavoured jar of sugar.
Just mix it with sugar, or what?
Yep, you just take the flowers off and put them in a jar of sugar, as much or as little as you like. But I have violet sugar, lavender sugar, thyme sugar, lilac sugar. So it just adds, you know, you can do a Victoria sponge.
So the smell of the lilac is what the...
Exactly.
Lilac sugar tastes of.
And you can make lilac sugar syrup, and it's really nice in your gin and tonic.
Right. But you said you could also put it in the cake, the lilac sugar in the sponge.
Yeah, so I use lilac sugar in Victoria sponge. We also use a scented pelargonium, which is not so much foraged as propagated.
Yeah, what, the leaves?
The leaves. We use it in our strawberry and raspberry jam, and it's ever so delicious. It's just like a subtle citrusy rose fragrance. And it just gives like a different edge, or you can line your tin with pelargonium leaves and bake a Victoria sponge, and then you should have this scented Victoria sponge. It's really subtle.
Yeah, oh, yeah. That's tremendous. And elderflower, you said you make fritters.
Champagne, I've never had any luck with elderflower champagne. I like drinking it. But yeah, elderflower fritters, you just make a tempura batter with sparkling water and lightly dip them in and fry them, and they're just lovely to crunch as a nice light dessert.
And presumably you make an elderflower cordial, do you?
My boyfriend's really into foraging, so he does all of the drinks, I do the food.
Yeah, right. And anything else then? What about things like Alexander's?
Alexander's are really nice. You can just lightly fry them. You do have to be careful with identifying Alexander's, so that you don't get any of the nightshade families. You know,
the deadly nightshade, particularly.
Get your skin, yeah. But they're in abundance in British hedgerows, and yeah, you can lightly fry the stalks, you can eat the leaves, like sprinkle them on top of salad. Another one is wild garlic. That's great. Make pestos with it. We pop it in quiches. The flowers are a really beautiful garnish for salads as well.
And nettles?
Nettles, yeah. What have we been doing with nettles? Again, we've been making lovely nettle and stilton quiches at the moment, which has been a special in the shop this week. We've actually done a spring roll. So we've done an Asian spring roll with nettles. And then last year we made an elderberry shrub. And that is a lovely vinaigrette to dip the spring rolls in.
Well, the leaves from elder?
So when the flowers turn into berries, right. you can pick the berries and then make them into, like, it's almost like a flavouring, like you would use a soy sauce or a Liam Perrins or a mushroom ketchup. I mean, it's very laborious. You have to pick a lot of berries, but it makes really lovely. You can find us through Instagram, The Linton Kitchen, and Facebook, The Linton Kitchen. And then our new business is Cocafune, C-O-C-A-F-U-N-E. And you can find out about all the events we've got going on and all the different menu changes are regularly on Instagram stories.
Lovely. Thank you very much.
And that was Gemma Whiting from Linton Kitchen.
Yeah, a very good place. Actually, most nettles I've seen are past their best because they're in flower. You need ones that aren't in flower. We've one more recipe idea coming up after this next feature, by the way.
Now for a spot of food history. Leslie Steinitz is a Cambridge researcher who's looking into the history of health food, one of which is Bovril.
Bovril is, for those people that don't know, it's sort of a thick black liquid gloop which was made by heating beef for a long period of time and then condensing it back down to make this very thick, almost syrupy but incredibly salty, aromatic juice, which you'd make into, amongst other things, a hot drink. Bovril has been so much part of British identity and British history, and it's quite iconic, even though the youth of today typically haven't heard of it, much to my disappointment.
They prefer Marmite, but there we are.
And what blew me away was the 19th century advertising for this, which pulled in politics, pulled in ideas of nationalism and pride, how to be a real man, as well as nutrition and gentlemanliness, and a lot of these themes that I'd been learning about in the course of learning about the history of the 19th and the early 20th century. And that drove me to think about health foods more generally. As well as beef extracts, which carried the idea of protein, cocoa suddenly became a health food. It had always been sort of medicinal since its origins, but come the 20th century and the advent of nutritional science, protein became a very important thing. Protein was what made you strong, and protein was very expensive because it mostly came in the form of meat, and this was the thing that was highly esteemed. But it turns out that cocoa powder can have a very high proportion of protein in it, up to, depending on how it's processed, up to 25%. And the purer the cocoa is, the less sugar that's added and so on and so forth, and the more fat that's taken out, the higher the proportion of protein. And some cocos, for example, Cadbury's, use this as promote themselves as a strengthening health food.
And I see you've got an advertisement for something called Tibbles Vi Coco. What is that?
That is, I think, probably the favourite of my substances. It's Dr. Tibbles Vi Coco, and it's a blended cocoa. And its most important ingredient was cola. Cola as in Coca-Cola. This was, in 1898, was the best, the nation's favourite cocoa. It was mentioned in Parliament. It was credited by the Chancellor for contributing towards the large increase in taxes he'd pulled in from cocoa, and it completely, but very briefly, but completely disrupted the cocoa market. It's the most, it's our Coca-Cola, ours in British, but nobody's ever heard of it because it didn't last very long. It completely ebbed away by the 1920s, but declined during the first decade of the century. And the thing was, cola is a very, was again something which was justified by science. Cola is very high, as you probably know from Coca-Cola, it's very high in caffeine. And this, again, just like protein, was brought into the discourse about masculinity, strength, and
vitality.
And Vicoco, the Vicoco company, was run by an advertising agent, one of the leading advertising agents of the time. He bought it from Dr. Tibbles indirectly, and he was had been a working class guy. He really understood the working class man very well. And his advertisements were absolutely spot on in pinpointing exactly what they were worried about and what they wanted then, which was to be able to get up in the morning and work in their awful factory or the freezing cold train or wherever it was that they worked, and to be able to keep going till the end of the day. And that's what he advertised it for. It will help you be a new man. It will, astonishingly good advertising, bringing out the scientific nature of cola, but expressing it in a way that was appealing to the individual with the self-help ethos that was so typical of the late 19th century.
And none of this was ever aimed at women then?
There were two distinct types of advert. The ones I'm talking about showed men at work, hard at work, not looking at whoever was drawing them, and being an upstanding provider. There were also a few adverts of women at work, and they were all nurses. They were far more timid in their statements. It's really unclear what a woman was getting out of Vicoco. I think they were advertising to the men and to the women that it was a thing for the men to use. Mm. And if a woman wanted her man to be robust and tough and work hard, this is what they needed to buy for them. That's until World War One, when, of course, all the men had gone away. And suddenly, Vicoco was represented by Little Miss Vi, who was this Mabel Atwell character, big eyes, big head, you know, doing the housework, or I should say girl, doing the housework and having Vicoco as a mid-morning pick-me-up. So the brand completely changed persona at that point. What I'm looking at in the PhD is, in a sense, it's the whole process from field to mouth. At the moment, I'm writing a chapter about cola, but I'm looking at how cola became something which was never seen in England, to something which people suddenly thought that they should have in their food, and therefore how that started to be cultivated and shipped here. And that was difficult because cola nuts don't last that long. And how it was popularised, how people were persuaded to do it.
Amazing to hear of cola as a health food. That was Leslie Steinitz.
Now, in our last programme, which you can still hear on the catch-up section of the Cambridge 105 radio website, also on iTunes and various other places, we had Rosie Sykes and Tristan Welch with ideas for asparagus. Well, asparagus is still very much available, so here is a further suggestion from Jamie Mountford that involves the wild food, Jack by the Hedge.
Jimmy, you got some ideas for asparagus with Jack by the Hedge.
Yes.
So this, I've never come across this combination before.
So what it is I'm very close to the guys at Cambridge Asparagus, who are just based down near Linton, actually. It's a farm. You know, they give me a text every year when they start producing the asparagus. I go down with a couple of lads from the kitchen and we go and pick our own asparagus. It's fantastic to do first time of the asparagus season. And then, you know, I love asparagus. It's an amazing ingredient. And when it's in its bloom, I really do pump it on the menu. You know, put it on specials. And it's so flexible, you know. Classic dishes, asparagus, poached egg, balsamic vinegar, parmesan. You know, one of the first dishes I ever learned to cook. Don't ever cook your asparagus for longer than 3 minutes. 3 minutes are perfect. And if you go to Cambridge Asparagus, you know, you pick it straight out of the field and it tastes like fresh peas. It's amazing. Mm-hmm. Yeah, plenty of salt on there. Sea salt I tend to use. And Jack by the Hedge is a foraged ingredient, which I was introduced to by Stephen down at the Green Man in Grantchester. And he was like, try this out. It's a bit of a mustard flavour. You know, it's fantastic with asparagus. So what I did was took this ingredient and what I did is I created a panna cotta, a savoury panna cotta. And I used a seaweed base, which is agar-agar. What I did was brought some milk and cream up to the boil, chucked the Jack by the Hedge in as I blitzed it as in the food processor, which keeps the green so it doesn't go too dark, so to speak. And then I added the agar-agar and set this. And this keeps it vegetarian as well. And also with the flowers from the Jack by the Hedge, you can garnish the dish with. So what I tend to do is get the asparagus, plunge it for 3 minutes straight into ice-cold water, and then put the panna cotta on the dish, chuck some wild mushrooms on there, plenty of shaved black truffle, and a touch of hollandaise. It's a fantastic dish, you know. And Jack by the Hedge is an ingredient that grows on the side of the road.
It's plentiful around Cambridge,
loads,
isn't it?
Loads. There's absolutely loads. Yeah. I tell you what, I do need to find it. I need to find a, because I love my foraging, you know. I take my son out foraging. Got wild garlic. I'm really struggling to find wild garlic.
Right, well, when we've stopped recording, I'll tell you where I find it.
But when you're foraging, please do, you know, as a chef, my job is to respect Mother Nature. My job is to manipulate flavours for a dish for people to try. You know, Mother Nature creates everything, and when you're picking things, make sure you leave a little bit more than what you've taken, so it gets a chance to grow back, and nature can take its course, really.
Yeah.
Jamie Mountford on asparagus there.
And that is Green Onions, signalling the start of our new section, and we begin as usual with jobs.
Rocker's Steakhouse on Cambridge Leisure Park, so near the junction and the light cinemas, is looking for a full or part-time chefs. Take your CV along to them and state if you want full or part-time. If the latter, say what times you're available. If you need to know anything else, give them a ring on 07970 263 105.
And if you're keen to work at the Leisure Park but Rockers isn't for you, you could try Nando's there instead. They want grill chefs, and details can be found on the Nando's website.
Charlie's in Burley Street is looking for a pizza chef, full-time and immediate start. You can pop in with your CV or just go chat to them about it.
The Ivy in Trinity Street wants an assistant general manager. Apply via the Ivy's website.
Hum Closen needs some help in her Meadows shop in Eltersley Avenue for 2 to 3 days a week, 6 to 8 hour shifts. It's open from Friday till Sunday. Relevant food, drink, retail or hospitality experience is desirable but not essential. Email meadowscambridge@gmail.com.
And that completes our local jobs roundup for today. Good luck if you're applying, and please let them know you heard about the job on Flavour here on Cambridge 105 Radio.
Right, on to some other news now, and on the 14th of June, Mark Poynton is at the 12A Club on Market Square. Tables from 6:30 to 9 p.m. The price is £50 for a 5-course tasting menu payable in advance. Drinks will be available on the night, and the menu includes broccoli soup with blue cheese fondue, cod pastrami, lamb rump with crispy haggis, basil and black olive jus, and Lancashire bomb rarebit and strawberry and elderflower mess.
Sounds rather nice. Mark is also hosting a night at Cambridge Cookery in Purbeck Street, and that's on the 19th of June, and there are still a small number of places left. For both these events, book via Mark's website, mjprestaurant.com.
Another event at Cambridge Cookery in Purbeck Street is on the 14th of June, when Steve Hovington of the Cambridge Wine Academy is hosting a night of fresher, lower alcohol wine tasting. Tickets are £20, available from the Cambridge Wine Academy website. That's from 7 till 8:30pm.
And there's a foodie festival heading to Cambridge on the 28th to the 30th of June on Parker's Peace. One of the things happening is that Tristan Welch will be cooking a number of delicious dishes, including a joint demonstration with Chef Alex Rushmer, and there'll be various MasterChef finalists and Bake Off winners there as well. Also, bookings are now open for August at Van der Lyle in Mill Road. There are also 4 spaces available this month and a few in July.
And finally, one of the top Cambridge colleges for food is Corpus Christi in King's Parade. And they're having a dinner on the 13th of September during this year's Open Cambridge. It's a very reasonable £40 a head for 3 courses, and there are vegetarian options too. The menu includes confit sea trout or tomato gazpacho with celery mousse, slow-cooked pork belly or summer vegetable risotto, and treacle tart with sherry compote and chantilly cream. You can inquire or book on Cambridge 761 539 or email conferences@corpus.cam.ac.uk.
And that's all we have time for today. Flavour broadcast live on alternate Saturdays at 1 p.m. is repeated on Sunday at 2 p.m. and then podcast early the following week.
And if you'd like to get in touch with any news or comment when we're off the air, you can email us flavour@cambridge105.co.uk or via Twitter @flavour105.
And coming up on Cambridge 105 Radio today at 2 o'clock is Bookmark with Lee Chambers. And later this evening, in fact, at 9 o'clock, Paul Cristoforo's Rock of Ages has John Clements looking back on the 50th anniversary of Pink Floyd's last gig in Cambridge and his own involvement with Strawberry Fair. But that's all from us. Flavour will be back on the 22nd of June. So until then, goodbye.